register now at kfpl.beanstack.com.
He could be 30. He could be 50. Life has aged him beyond his years. A shopping cart carries everything he owns. Here he comes, toward you. What you think you know about how he got here is probably wrong. Don't let homelessness assumptions get in the way of homelessness solutions. Go to CanadaCanDoIt.ca. Help the Canadian Alliance to End Homelessness. Gotcha.
Good day, and welcome to the summer season of Grad Chat. The episode you're about to listen to is a repeat from our previously aired shows. We hope that you enjoy today's repeat episode of Grad Chat with CJ the DJ on CFRC 101.9 FM. Gotcha.
G'day and welcome to a Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is CJ the DJ and I am your host for this week's Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, as well as CFRC. So thank you very much to both of them. Now, if your mates missed the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify and CFRC Podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, though, I would like to introduce you to Heather Morrison, who is doing a PhD in education under the supervision of Dr. Richard Reeve. Welcome to Grad Chat, Heather.
Thank you, and it's very nice to be here.
Winter is here. Finally, we got some snow last week. Well, it was a week ago now, and who knows? That might be it.
Well, I hope not. I love snow.
I'm still getting used to it, I guess. I was kind of enjoying working on the golf course and not having to worry about slush and stuff. But anyway, that's the way things go. So before we get onto your research, can you give us some background of your journey that ultimately brought you to continue your education? Where are you from? All those sorts of wonderful things for us to find out.
I'm originally from PEI.
Excellent. And I think you're probably my first one from PEI that I know of anyway.
I moved to Kingston in 2023. I think of life like chapters in a book. And so that was probably the second chapter. No, let's go with the third. The third chapter of my life. So teenagehood, young adulthood. And then I moved here when I was 35. And I moved without a job because I wanted to live in this city. I love this city. I fell in love with it, visiting it over the years. And when I arrived, I rented a little house on Clergy Street.
Okay. Not far.
Across the street was a building. A new building was being built, going up, and I kept looking at it and thinking, I wonder what that's going to be. And the other thought I was having persistently was, I need a job and I want to work in a women's shelter. Lo and behold, it turned out to be Kingston's new women's shelter. So I worked there for 5 years.
Fantastic.
Frontline counseling. Also, in the second chapter of my life, I was a programmer, a computer programmer and tech support person. So I did that work in the shelter. I did frontline counseling and I did a small workshop at 1.2 on transitional housing.
Wow.
So that was fun.
That's a lot of different things there, from IT to counseling, and all very good, of course.
Lots of different
things.
All
applied.
Yeah, hands-on. Mm-hmm. All with the goal of improving the lives of women and children in everything that I worked in. I worked as an ECE, early childhood educator. I was the executive director of a women's equality-seeking organization back in PEI. And had a little side trip into IT, but when I really had some skills and I was ready to do something different, I wanted to take that back to the social service world.
Right.
So I was really lucky to land this position at Kingston Interval House. After being there, 5 years, I was ready for a change, and I saw an advertisement with the Sexual Assault Center Kingston. They were starting a young women's program, and their definition at that time was girls age 12 to 18.
Right.
So essentially those in the school system who were coming into contact with the law, testifying as survivors in sexual assault cases.
Not easy.
And no, and very brave, very, very brave young women. Court ended up being a big part of the counseling support that I did because of their age. If you're under 16, you still don't have the right to decide if charges will be laid in your behalf. And when you're over 16, you do have a choice. And so a lot of the cases I worked on, there was an intersection between hospital, school, lots of times Children's Aid Society, and the criminal justice system.
That's brilliant. But then what made you go from doing that to coming back and doing a PhD?
So I did that for a decade and covered a large catchment area, 4,200 kilometers, 300,000 people.
Wow.
So both counties, this one, Frontenac all the way up to Northbrook, Calder, back down to Napanee and over to Kingston. And I was in the schools all the time.
Okay.
I'd really say my primary identification would be as a life coach or a teacher, but not the type of person who teaches reading.
Right.
But teaches life skills.
Which is just as important. You walk around, there's a lot of kids that don't have those life skills.
It's true.
Yeah.
It's
for whatever reason.
For lots of reasons.
There's certain things that the education system should be doing, and then others that they can do part of it, but it shouldn't be their sole responsibility.
That's right. And so much of learning, and we'll talk about this later, happens in what we call the public sphere.
Yes.
And I'll talk a little bit about the public sphere when I start to talk about my research. Mm-hmm. So an observation I had when I was working with the girls, I had about 300 clients over that decade, was that I wanted to take them places in society, in town, on field trips where they could see women's empowerment in play.
Right, right, yes.
So we would go every year to Take Back the Night, and there was at that time a journal that Queen's Gender Studies, I guess it was Women's Studies then, was producing. So my girls.
That's nice though.
They were young women.
I
was very attached, and I think I did some work and research on attachment and learning in my master's degree here at Queen's.
Right.
So I think that's a really important part of any learning or healing process, which is they're essentially built on the same set of principles and skill development. But my girls wrote for this journal every year and submitted poetry and art, and they were really excited to be part of the university.
That must be quite eye-opening, not only for them, but for you as well, reading some of the things that they're writing, but for them, an opportunity for them to express what's going on.
Absolutely. And then to come to Stauffer for a reception and watch this journal be launched and to see their words in writing at Queen's, at this institution.
Yeah.
Living in Kingston and for many years not being part of the Queen's environment, I can tell you that there's a big glass wall all the way around.
Thinking you can't get in.
That's right.
Yeah.
And particularly, like a majority of the kids I worked with were living with multiple ACEs in their lives, which is adverse early childhood experiences.
Right.
So poverty was...
So they wouldn't often get an opportunity to come to an institution like this, which I'm glad to say things are changing on that front, where we're giving more opportunities for people from all backgrounds, regardless of whether they've got the money or not, to be able to come.
I think we have a long way to go.
We do, but it's a start.
We have to start somewhere.
Yes.
And certainly in my time as on the board of directors of the Children's Aid Society here in Kingston and chairing that organization, I was involved at the time when both St. Lawrence College and Queen's started to provide free tuition for kids who had been wards or in permanent care of the society.
Right.
So that certainly helped to break that glass ceiling of first generational education or higher education.
It's like I said, it's a start, isn't it? But certainly having someone like you also supporting them along the way for their own personal growth, that must have been quite rewarding for you.
It was. Do you want me to tell you
what
made me think about doing that?
Yes.
Okay, I'll just keep talking.
Yeah, go for
it. Let's go back. I don't think that any of us become who we are without a lot of influence from our families.
Yes.
And growing up in PEI family was very important. My mother was orphaned by the time she was six due to domestic violence. And the thing that she always attributed to having saved her life was she was really smart.
Right.
She was a strategic thinker, but she had lots of intelligence and she was able to get a good education in a traditional field in the 50s, which was nursing. On the other side of my family, my father's father came back from World War II quite injured, and
right.
he contributed some other things and in the end ended up with a doctorate, honorary doctorate from UPEI. But in the time my father was growing up, his mother was the primary financial,
is that right?
Financial support and caregiver in the family. And of her eight children, seven have degrees or postgraduate degrees.
Wow.
And they lived on potatoes.
Right.
And she was insistent that there would be education. So I come from this background that education is everything.
It's important.
It's a silver bullet, mm-hmm. right, to changing the trajectory of people's lives.
Yep.
My mother went on to open the first daycare center in PEI. And so I grew up from age three until I was 30. We ran a daycare center, sometimes as many as 60 children.
Wow.
And I first started teaching kids when I was 10. I would take the wild thing kids, the kids who right. couldn't sit down. And we have all kinds of labels for them now. Neurodiverse.
I prefer wild thing. Let's go out and have some fun. They don't want to sit down.
No. And teach them to read when they were five. And right. it was really easy to do. And I could never understand what was wrong with all the adults in the world. But anyway, there you go. Sometimes that peer-to-peer relationship.
Exactly. We know that.
Helps a lot. So bundling all those things up, when I was working at the Sexual Assault Center with the young women, I really wanted to take them to social justice school.
Right.
And there wasn't a location like, oh, let's go over here and learn about social justice and women's rights. So I developed lots of training material and did right. group work with them and took them to places in the city that offered opportunities. In the meantime, my father, actually, driving back from Florida, discovered Women's Rights Museum, which is in Seneca Falls.
Oh, okay.
Seneca Falls is 3 hours south of Kingston as the crow flies.
Which is not far.
Not at all. And it's a national park, actually, that the U.S. government funds and maintains. And it teaches people the history of women's rights in the United States.
That's brilliant.
It's lovely. I've been there many times. It's free.
Like, even better. That's great.
That's public pedagogy, yes. which I'll talk more about later. So I guess, like, a lot of things come together. I'm not 24. I'm bringing a lot of life experience into my time here at Queen's. I am 56. As near as I can tell from all the biohackers, I could easily live to be 100. So I'm only halfway through.
I love that. I love it. That's great.
That's good. It's fun. I have some more work to do yet.
Which is great because you clearly want to help people.
And I've always, actually, I was a kid who flunked out of grade 10 and grade 12. And I was academically dismissed from university in the beginning. And I was somebody really.
You weren't ready for it. Not everyone's ready to do education at certain points in time.
I wasn't. And I know lots of things now about what was happening in my own life then that were precluding me from being academically successful.
Right.
And some of those skills are quite teachable. And so when the pandemic came and I wasn't working any longer, I decided that I would finish my master's in education here at Queen's under Ted Christo, who's
yes.
a dear, dear mentor.
Yes, and of course he's moved on.
Yes, well, I started off with John Freeman and he passed away mm-hmm. when I was early into my degree. And so I was one of those people at a time in our faculty who got orphaned. I kept getting picked up by someone,
right.
but there was a lot of shift in movement.
Right.
And so in some ways it was beneficial because I learned from a lot of different
yes.
people.
Yes, that's very true.
But in the end, Ted was willing to take me on and help me finish through the pandemic. And so my research for my master's in education is on complex childhood trauma and learning. And I'm a neurodiverse thinker as well, which is another way to say I'm a wild thing. not following a path, like a normal path. I decided I didn't want to write a thesis. I can't sit still long enough. I find it difficult. I'm learning how to do it now in a PhD. All that to say, you know, people who come to higher education with imposter syndrome, you don't need to come here thinking you can do it all. You come here to learn how to do it.
Yes.
And I had that same anxiety entering, like, I can't do this. Like, how am I going to do this? How am I going to do a PhD? That was last week. I'm in my third year.
And this week.
So for 6 days solid, I followed a plan and a routine, and I have a lot more confidence.
There you go. You see, it all works out in the end.
It does.
So what I want to talk about now, because we could get straight into your research, but there's still something else I want to bring to everyone's attention, is that you are the founder of the Canadian Museum of Women's History. What made you want to do this? Is this something from the Seneca Museum or thing on social justice? Does it come from that, or is it something else?
Well, let's start with this.
And what is it?
What is it? The museum itself? Okay, so let's start with this. When people ask me, what made you want to build a museum? The first thing that comes to mind is the debate night that was on television between Trump and Hillary Clinton. Okay. Do you remember this? And the scene, he's walking around behind her.
Yep.
And talking over her and making gestures and faces behind her as she speaks. And I thought to myself, well, look at that. There's patriarchy showing itself full blown on my television, misogyny at the highest levels. Yeah. And he was never once called out.
No, I know. And I never understood why not.
By a mediator, a moderator, or... Yeah. I mean, she attempted to deflect some of his behavior. But why? I mean, it's the whole scenario. Why is the woman left to have to say, your behavior is not okay?
It's inappropriate, yeah.
So that's the first thing that comes to mind. And I think, how many women watching that and how many men thought that behavior was acceptable? And how are we going to help people? I mean, that was, well, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm going to say 2014 or 15 in that area.
He came in the 2016, didn't he?
So it'd be 15, probably even November, like it was late into those debates. If in that, like 2015, people still couldn't see that this was problematic, oh yeah, by the way, and then they elected him with this behavior, like blatant behavior, we obviously haven't done our job, whoever we is, we being society, the educators, the social justice warriors, and I love the term myself, to educate the public about how misogyny plays out and how it works and the effects it's having on women, children, and men.
Right.
So I thought, what we need here is a school, a social justice school.
So you're calling it a school, not a museum?
In my mind, it's a school.
Right.
It's a social justice school. When I was working on my master's one day, I was whining about having to write a paper, and I was, you know, Duncan Hall.
Yes.
And the education library overlooks P4W, which is the former prison for women. And I was sucking, whining about having to write this paper, and I looked out the window, and literally across the road, I could see the barred windows where women would have been imprisoned and looking back across at the university.
At an educational facility.
At an opportunity.
Right.
The difference between the opportunity those women had in their lives, especially in their childhoods, and what I'd had in mine, and the majority of people who would have been attending university, was stark. Stark. The difference was, it's measurable, but it's stark. And so education is the answer. Initially, I thought, well, that building is sitting there empty. That would be the perfect place for a National Women's Museum. It's still empty. There's lots of work happening.
Yes.
But it's not, nothing is completely settled. It's owned by a developer, was sold from Queens to a developer. I believe it's a UNESCO site waiting to happen with the Canadian Museum of Women's History in it. So I kind of haven't given up on that idea yet.
That's awesome.
Yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, well, you know what? We've got to keep working on those sorts of things. Because first of all, that building, you're right, it's been sitting there for a long time. It's been empty since I arrived. I was 2017. I think we still had all the walls up. I think it was after that the walls came down, bar one. but it would be a perfect spot,
wouldn't it?
Absolutely perfect spot for it, and particularly being a school or museum with the historical side behind it, which is why it's always been an issue trying to develop it.
Yes.
It makes perfect sense.
It does. We have to run through some capitalist hoops yet to find out if that's going to be the case, but no doubt in my mind. Now, there's a group of like a board of directors that are running the organization I've started, and there's myself. And so with my board of directors hat on, we'll be happy to receive any space that's willing to host
us.
Heather's dream is that we go in that building, but nothing has just been decided.
Well, don't give up, put it that way.
Okay.
So let's get on then to your research. So your research is about, called, if I've got this correct, could a national museum dedicated to women's history as a vehicle for public pedagogy strengthen liberal democracy in Canada?
So there's a small idea to try it and was do a in one paper.
I know.
You can't even read it all in one sentence.
I know. I had to sort of break it up a little bit there to make sure I was reading things correctly. Tell me a little bit about that. What are you trying to accomplish?
I was finishing my master's and I thought, this is it. This is my chance to apply for a PhD. So I said to Ted, I'd like to do a PhD. And so he, you know, did the pitch and he said, what do you want to do it on? And I gave him this topic and he was like, do it, do it, do it. Because he's a museum guy, right? He loves museums. He loves the Greeks. He loves learning. And if you read that sentence again, start with this, the first little bit.
Could a national museum dedicated to women's history as a vehicle for public pedagogy?
We'll stop there. So let's talk about public pedagogy.
Yeah.
Public pedagogy. I want to talk a little bit about public and the public sphere.
Yes.
And I will talk about pedagogy. Well, let's do pedagogy quickly because it's a really, I'll say, easy definition compared to the other. But pedagogy is the art of teaching and how we disseminate information and encourage learning. Mm-hmm. That's pedagogy. So public sphere is very connected to democracy. In fact, you can't have a true democracy without a strong public sphere. And when I talk about public sphere, I talk about everything that happens outside of current institutions. Maybe some discussion happens inside institutions, yeah, but really it's the birth of policy. So whenever a vibrant public sphere emerges, people are emancipated from imposed authority. That's a big sentence to chew.
It is a big sentence.
So it happens in this way. Ideas are presented. And maybe it's like, let's take the example of a community group that forms to direct or solve a particular problem in a neighborhood. Issues are debated, so everyone has a voice and is heard equally. Public opinion is then formed.
Right.
And from there, social action takes root.
Right.
So the action comes from the ideas and the debate. And it from that place, the public sphere goes on to influence public and therefore public policy is developed.
Right, so this is where public pedagogy can strengthen liberal democracy.
That's right. So when we're talking about public in the public sphere, mm-hmm, and that's the public and the public sphere. Pedagogy is the art of teaching. So if we put those two ideas together, what the public is learning outside the current institutions of learning that are like big L learning. So that would be colleges, universities, public schools. When we talk about public pedagogy, lots of that is happening in libraries.
Yes.
Museums. It's happening here between us right now on the podcast. Public pedagogy happens in commercials.
And performance.
Art. The best example I can think of recent history of public pedagogy was the federal government's rollout of the COVID vaccines.
Right.
Why we need them, what they're going to do to help people, where you can go to get them. And there was lots of room left for debate, and people were not forced to accept the vaccine. They were given a choice. That's all part of public pedagogy, right, being able to have a dissent in opinion.
So what would you put in this National Museum dedicated to women?
So this museum is a social justice school. The first things that we need to all understand, and there hasn't been a place to do this yet, is how did women move from not being able to vote or even be considered persons in 1929, which was the person's case,
right,
to today, when we have much higher levels of equality? Have we reached full equality? No, of course not. It's really evident. I don't think I need to sit here and give you a list of stats.
No, you're right.
Right? I mean, it's 2023 now. We know. But part of continuing social change is teaching people how social change has evolved over time, and basically what are the tools that work. And this sort of an institution will do that.
So is it more, I mean, I know museums, historical museums, talk about period pieces, and this happened in this period, and this happened in this period. But if you want it to be more of not just people walking through, oh, that's interesting, but to go away and think more about what they've just seen, how are you going to make that work?
I think we're not going to send them away. We're going to try and build community around the space.
Okay.
So not only will there be displays and opportunities to walk through and see artifacts, there'll be opportunities to learn on site. We will have public opportunities for lectures, for gatherings, for learning. For example, maybe the Indigenous women would be willing to come and offer a cooking class.
Right.
And that is public pedagogy, and that's women's history, and that's cultural diversification.
So it's really getting the community that this particular place is going to be really involved.
Yes.
So it's not just museum curators. It's everyone getting involved, that hopefully people from outside the community also want to come in.
Absolutely.
Be a part of.
Absolutely. And where we can have a public sphere of conversations and debates and help move public policy further ahead. There is an International Association of Women's Museums.
Okay,
there
that was one of my questions here. I mean, are there others around the world?
There are probably, let me see, on any given day, like 30 national museums. There are 75 forms of women's museums.
Okay.
They may be specific to a region or a genre, like there's a cowgirls women's museum.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if I'm even saying it right. Some are particularly focused on art. Some are focused on political rights,
right,
which is really more, I'm hoping that this one will be many things. And when I say I, my goal is to build a frame and then invite a larger conversation in to say,
right,
what do we want to do with the space?
Right.
We're going to have a little test run of this. I forgot to share this with you.
Well, tell us about that. How are you going to test it?
We're going to have a little test run. The City of Kingston in December, through their Heritage Fund, awarded us a small grant.
Excellent.
To host a pop-up women's museum.
Brilliant.
Yeah, it's great.
And where are you going to put that?
We're going to put it in Memorial Hall.
Fantastic.
So I should be clear, too, that this museum is going to live in Kingston.
Which is great.
Kingston is going to be the home of Canada's National Women's Museum. I've had some great conversations with the city. Nobody signed anything or promised away anything, but we've had conversations about locations, and the city is very keen to have this here. Primarily because its tagline is, this is the city of museums. There are 33 museums in Kingston.
Oh, God, I didn't realize there was that many.
There are.
Well, that's well, 34.
34, yes. So we're going to have the pop-up museum is going to be at City Hall. We're going to have an October 19th. That's a Saturday.
Right.
Free admission.
Fantastic.
The city is giving us the space. October 18th is Persons Day in Canada. That's the day that women were declared persons legally.
Right.
October is also Women's History Month in Canada.
Right.
So it fits nicely.
So Heather, we're going to have to stop, I think. We could keep going.
I told you I could talk a lot.
But we do need to stop.
3 minutes of talking is never going to work.
But I'm going to have you coming back anyway, because I'm sure you've got lots more to tell us how things are progressing a little bit later. And I'd love to learn more about how the pop-up goes.
I would love to come in and do a little recruiting when we have the pop-up.
Not a problem. So let's do that. But thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story so far.
Thank you for having me. This is an absolute gift to have the time to talk.
Brilliant, brilliant. So, as I say to everyone, that's it for another week of Grad Chat, which sadly comes to an end. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ signing off with a big hooray. Grad Chat.
Grad Chat. Sego.
Buju, Anin.
Danach A. Ak Anzen Shukwithan.
Tante.
This is Words and Culture, a series on Indigenous languages, funded by SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
I'm Madeleine Alakrilik, your host for Words and Culture, about Inuktitut and the language of us Inuit. What you just heard me do is called katajak. In English, you may have heard it to be as throat singing. Those were the exact sounds that my grandmother started teaching to me at a very young age. It's a form of song very unique to Inuit and known to be only by Inuit, but it is also compared to the Mongolian style of singing called duva. It's different though. Katajak is commonly known to be between two women facing each other, holding each other's arms. And this is because when one woman makes a sound, her partner in front of her makes the exact same sound, but just half a second after. And then they both create music with imitations, like sounds of birds, or dog sleds. Even mosquitoes. And it has to be in rhythm, but of sounds that we hear in our Arctic environment. And it's also very comical to make all these sounds in front of another person. So it makes you laugh. If you can imagine, just more than 50 years ago, this was a way to board beat 'em. It was a competition between two women to see who begins to start laughing first. And so in my case, I was a baby. I was on my grandmother's back in her ulipakak, and that's a shawl-like baby carrier that my Anansiak Mini would put me to sleep in. And she would walk around with me on her back and swaying back and forth. And these were the sounds of nature, but they were also lullabies. And it sure put us to sleep. These days, though, not only Inuit women sing them, and not only are they lullabies. Many Inuit have told me that the album that I put out a long time ago, Tujut, it helped restore this form of throat singing. This form of our singing that was banned when Christianity was introduced to the camps of our grandparents before they were all moved to communities. And so throat singing apparently was the music of evil, according to the church or the Christians that came up to our communities, to our homelands. And so as such, Inuit women stopped creating these beautiful natural sounds. My guest today explains how he learned the throat songs from his own grandmother and describes how an elder from Puvernituk in Nunavik brought the revival of Katajak back into our lives, and that was in the 1960s. Going back to my grandmother, she had seven daughters and then me. Of those daughters, only Auntie Dora and Raingi learned this form of our culture from Anansiak. And then there was me. After being relocated to the high Arctic in the 1950s from her homelands in Inukjuaq, Nunavik, my grandmother Minnie used to entertain tourists and those heading to the North Pole from Resolute Bay, where my family was moved to. And that was her way of making time pass, because We have very long, dark winters up there, 24 hours of darkness for months. And when the sunshine came and the tourists came, that's when Minialakirelak showed all those visitors what throat singing was. My cousin Robbie has done many things in his life. However, most recently, he is a director from the Office of the Commissioner of Indigenous Languages over in Ottawa. Robbie joins me today, and first we'll talk about throat singing because Robbie is one of a very few Inuit men who can actually throat sing, and it sounds very beautiful and it's very unique to the throat songs you may hear from Inuit women. Anitsarauna tunga sutisimmi javullumi katatjasungwaralo nimigami anansia har nimigami katatjasumi taktsumani pingat tusarnilaritto arnai katatjasugutillugit suusuune sautillugit takkoangutisuummi mata tanna katatjasitialummi joq ullumi pulaartigisimmi javut taima tunga suttitauli. Please welcome Robbie Watt to Words and Culture.
Thank you very much. Great intro. I feel welcomed already.
You've done so many things in your life, but I just, before we get into the topic of the work that you do in Ottawa, I want to get our listeners to know you a little bit and things that not everyone may know, but in this conversations around words and culture, as Inuit, I'm going back to the time I recall meeting you at the first ever throat singing conference in Puvemlito, Nunavik, Northern Quebec. And it was a very special time, and you were standing there and you recognized an elder. Do you remember this? I'm taking you back quite a number of years.
Yes. Yes, that was a time when Avatak hosted a gathering of throat singers from all across Canada. I don't think we had everyone there, but we had invited close to around 50 to 60 participants to have our first ever throat singing gathering to try and get organized, because, you know, throat singing is quite unique within our culture, and we wanted to kind of find ways to safeguard it, make sure that there is ways to support our throat singers, find ways to network, maybe have this throat singing ability to be transferred adequately within our younger generations, et cetera, et cetera. And the reason why we were there was, back in the 50s and 60s, it was that gentleman that we were honoring. His name was Isaac Bekoaluk, for bringing back throat singing. He retaught his daughters how to throat sing back in the 1950s. And that's how throat singing is thriving today.
So it's such an incredible story. And I think the revitalization of throat singing is very, it's out there. It's whatever we did to preserve throat singing, I think everyone who did that work deserves recognition, because we have young people mixing throat singing through all genres, and people around the world can identify throat singing and relate it to Inuit. I just want you to share your experience with throat singing and your ability to throat sing, because Mostly Inuit women have throat sing, but you are like, no, my grandma taught me too, and I love it.
Well, my mom's from the Inuit, from the Hudson Coast region. My dad's from Kudrak, which is from the Angawa Coast. So most summers, we spent summer in Inuit / around the Hudson Coast area. And during that summer, I always had an opportunity to go hunting with my grandfather, Adatia. One time at Adatia, I was around maybe 6 or 7, my Adatia dropped me off at this old lady's camp. And he left. I think he was going to go to Inukjuak for a couple of days, get food, come back. And I was brought to this old lady's camp to babysit. And in the evenings, in the morning, she walk along the shoreline looking for driftwood. And she'd be making this sound. And just really, I was like enthralled. Like I wanted to hear more and more. And I started trying and secretly. And in Inukjuak, when I get back, I'd be kind of like a reporter. Sammy Arnatuk, we called him Chicken Sam, had a radio station, an FM radio station in Inukjuak. So I said, I have a story to tell you. And so I would tell him about this sound that I was hearing, throat singing sound. And so he'd let me, well, I want to hear it, Robbie. I want to hear it. So I'd throat sing in town. And that's how it started. And the following year, I learned a little bit more. So I went back to the FM station and see what I learned more. And then I had a little brother that was old enough that I could teach. So there was a, what you call a True North concert that was going to be taking place. And we were asked if we could perform there. So I taught Billy how to throat sing. He was a bit shorter than I am. So he had a milk box that he stood on so that we could be more eye to eye level. And that's how it was. Billy was probably a much better throat singer than I was. But yeah, that's how my story is with throat singing.
It's amazing. I remember seeing that video and just being amazed because I grew up listening to my grandmother and her throat singing with my aunties, but I had never seen two young men throat singing. And the sounds were so beautiful and very deep. Do you still throat sing today?
Of course I do. But riding a bicycle, once you learn how to ride a bike, you can never unlearn. So what a silly question to ask.
I'm sorry.
And when someone says, can you demonstrate for us? I will always gladly say, sure. I am just very alone here. A couple of times I have actually, when I was a student in Winnipeg, when I used to be asked to go to teach throat singing, but I didn't have a partner. So what I do is I record myself first with a tape recorder and I use that as my partner.
That's amazing. Well, I'm not going to pass this up, but can you demonstrate the sounds that you learned from the old lady and the camp that you were up on?
So there's this basic one that she would be doing. Stuff like that.
Even the, you have the original sound where the original throat singers, the women from Inukjuak and Puvernitok specifically, they were fast. It's very different today. You find that too?
Some of them are faster in some songs, like the Himiguluapik. Some of them go really, really fast in the West Central Arctic more. I love any kind of throat singing.
Me too.
Contemporary, traditional. I think there's space for everyone to be able to feel that they are demonstrating some form of throat singing. Some traditionalists do not appreciate, that are too contemporary, maybe too visual. Throat singing could be looked at something a bit too sensual sometimes, especially with the sounds that it makes. But when a performer uses those gestures, it really can turn off a group of people that just don't want to have throat singing associated with that kind of. So, you know, there's space for everything. And I think a key is just to accept the fact that there is different ways for expression and there is no right way as long as we just respect each other's space. Mm-hmm. So singing is He's got a lot of, it's not just Inuit, that throat singing. There's different types of throat singing too that are occurring. There's the Tuvok throat singing. There's the Mongolian throat singing that is also in place. And it's not just, in those cultures, they're mainly men versus us, where it's said that it's only for women. But how can that be when a man, like Isaac, brought back throat singing? So I think being very gender specific can also alienate or prevent people like myself to wanna throat sing. Like, I don't really find myself out there trying to demonstrate throat singing, knowing the fact that some people say it's only for women.
What can you say about how far Isa's work and throat singing today, amidst all the frustration or the back and forth of who should and who shouldn't, I really like what you said. How do you feel about the world now knowing, because there is a lot of people who identify particularly our type of throat singing as Inuit, to Inuit culture, and what has it done for us?
Well, I give kudos, big time kudos to Tanya. I really, really, really think that she really kind of went against the current and did what she wanted to do without any fear. I mean, I'm sure that she was getting a lot of, but when I hear her, I just stand up and I want to hear more. She's great. She's wild. She's been awarded and recognized nationally and internationally, and good for her. And we need more people like that. And I think there is space for everyone to flourish. I really, really, a couple of times even people that are from the church, from our churches in the north, have come and said, we would really like to see if there's a way that we could kind of blend in throat singing with our songs, with our church songs.
Really?
Yeah, so I've always said, you know, there's space for everything.
Mm-hmm. Can you help our listeners who might not be familiar with the history and the importance of the resurgence of our culture through throat singing, why it was important to bring back? Say, can you help them understand what happened?
So, language, culture, identities are related to identity. And what I have learned is that there are some young people that have lost their language. And are very, very, they're aching to know more about their culture, wanting to have their identity be affirmed that we are Inuit. And some of them have found ways of getting that feeling back through learning how to throat sing. It's not just throat singing, but it's their artistic expressions, the way they clothe, they would put it in their clothes, anything that shows their identity could be just as powerful as someone saying, well, I know my language. So I find that very important. It can bring way to healing going on any kind of journey, including a healing journey whereby you will eventually learn to take on the challenge of relearning your language.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about identity. It's all about who am I? Who am I in this world? And everyone wants to feel they belong. And sometimes, unfortunately, what happens is that lateral violence is very rampant, and no matter what kind of violence it is, lateral violence could be any form, and it could be towards anything, and unfortunately it is even towards people who's more Inuk, who's less Inuk. And it could be all about the fact that you can't speak your language, so you're less Inuk now. I mean, those are the kind of dialogues that are unfortunately happening in our world.
Mm-hmm. It's so important to hear from someone like you say that, and I'm so glad you put it out there so that we face it, we identify it, we face it, and discuss it, because you're absolutely right. You and I, because we speak Inuktitut, are no better than our peers or our children that don't, correct?
There's about almost 9 billion Inuit people in the world now. Just in my worldview, my first worldview, in northern Quebec, we're only 13,000 plus Inuit. When you expand it to the rest of Canada, we're only maybe around 60,000 Inuit. And then when you expand it to the circumpolar world, we're only about 100,000 Inuit. 170,000 versus 8.5 billion people in the world. We have a lot to offer. We have our culture, our way of life is part of this beautiful mosaic world that we live in. We're diverse. We bring diversity into this world. And why not just support each other to make sure that we are bringing this diversity and being proud of being Inuit.
You are listening to Words and Culture, Madeleine Alekirel-Lawunga. My guest this week is with Robbie Watt. He is the director at the Office of the Commissioner of Indigenous Languages Office in Ottawa. I asked him this time how the work he's been doing has been going since the office first opened in June of 2023. Here's my conversation with Robbie.
There are 70 plus Indigenous languages in Canada as we speak. Not to mention other various dialects. That doesn't include the dialects. Of those, half of the Indigenous languages alone are in British Columbia. So some are struggling. Some have one or two speakers left in their whole nation. And they're trying to find ways, definitely, to try and make sure that they take advantage or take note that these two speakers that are left. So they're trying to come up with ways of what plan can we have? What is the best way to try and optimize what's left? Some are thriving, according to United Nations. No language is safe. All our languages are vulnerable, no matter what which language group you belong in. Even amongst us Inuit, we need to do a lot of research, and we want to do a lot of research. In particular, I'll give myself an example. I'm traveling to Kutruk, and I'm in town, just visually observing, noticing that many of my children, my less than five-year-old little children, toddlers, are only speaking in English. What's going on here? Their parents are speaking to them in Inuktitut, but they're only responding in English. And that's a concern. That's a big concern. We have daycare centers in every community. I know that in some daycare centers, in some communities, are all unilingual, Inuit. And because of that, a non-Inuk child going through this unilingual daycare center speaks Inuktitut. She can speak Inuktitut to anybody. And then you have daycare centers that, for some reason or the other, can't seem to have the capacity to have all Inuit workers. So it's not standardized. In some daycares are all more Inuit, some are less Inuit. And that's having an impact. What kind of impact will that have in the future? Even though we say that 90% of us adults speak Inuktitut. what's going to happen. So I think we need to do a lot of research, a lot more research, be open to help maybe make, find indicators as to how we could maneuver around and strategize on ensuring that we don't lose our language. We know that there's a lot of technology, lots of TikTok, YouTube, all that stuff is very much at the fingertips of every child. We don't have enough of these programmings in place, programmings. Television also is all English or French. But I have to say that this is a dialogue that has been going on since I was a kid, you know. Our parents have been worried about us losing our language. And now it's us that's worried. And I think it's good to continue being worried, because if we become complacent and just not worry anymore, just takes 1 to 2 generations to lose a language. But we have to do a lot of research. We have to do a lot of promoting. We have to make rest of Canada know about our languages. I'm making sure right now to make sure that the office that we've created here in Ottawa is relevant. It's relevant to the communities that are speaking the Indigenous languages, that is there to support in any way. If they want to do some research, we're there to help. If they want to promote their languages, we're there to help. If they want to complain, and there's a process we've created. If, for example, if you did get funding from the federal government for any language programs and there's some kind of a dispute, that we are kind of like unlike the ombudsman for between the Indigenous group and the government. Mm-hmm. And we also are supportive of innovative projects that are going to help in new ways of teaching or learning a language. The purpose of our office is to make sure that we are creating more people to speak their languages. Mm-hmm.
That's so good to hear, and thank you for sharing that information. They're amazing reminders, and that's what we need to keep pushing forward with to stay united as Inuit Ila.
That was Robbie Watt. Robbie is a director of the Commissioner of Indigenous Languages in Ottawa. Ani nagaluang mataila o kausia pivot piko siya pivullo upin naganiat sa uta wapot sa pingnak to hangila gulo kanulima ang malusunalima at akiyang bihak suting na kung may ikait daw wakata kanutigi inuy at sa usungun ni mangata o kausivu ilko sivullo pitsu tigitsugi na kung may Robbie. If you want to learn some Inuktitut or any of the other Indigenous languages featured here on Words and Culture, please visit our website at wordsandculture.ca. You can click on the Resources tab to check out some of our vocabulary builders. Sometimes English words just twist my tongue. vocabulary. Now to twist your tongue, here are some words in Inuktitut that I'm going to leave you with to practice with. So in Inuktitut, when we greet each other, specifically mostly in Nunavik, when we say hello, we say ai. Ai. You say ai with a at the end of the word. Ai. Ai. However, because Inuit are living all across the circumpolar Arctic and our dialects are different, in the Qikiqtaaluk region, this would be in, if you look on the map on Baffin Island, they say Asuyutin. 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 That translates to, well, here you are. I love our language. I'm Madeline Alakarillak. Ale anak to khalang maleu khaus tinik pitu ti khare amik inuge mi lupi go supunga. I am very proud to be Inuk, and I am very proud to be able to share with you my interviews relating to our Inuktitut language. Until next time, inukatikai atsunai.
Words and Culture is made possible with funding from SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Words and Culture is produced by Kim Wheeler. Kaylin Belair is our audio engineer and editor.
Onigiwahi.
Gigawabamin. Soko seni denit e. Ninen yujishina.
Eko se.
Kakuhutau. We'll see you again.
On Saturday, August 24th, it all begins again. The ecstasy.
Stadium comes alive. Alex